137, present day, Mr. Grunberg, Mr. Taylor, Mr. Pettijohn, Mr. Phillips, and Norder, the chair. We're going to hear three bills today. Committee substitute for SB 1, Senate Bill 124, and House Bill 148, an act relating to private cause of action relating to mobile home warranties and transfer and enforcement of mobile bill, of mobile warranties. We'll hear that one first. We have people on the air who want to testify via teleconference. I do know that Mr. Sun and Mr. Clarkson are present, so we have a full committee. I believe we have, well, as I say, we'll take up House Bill 148 first. I believe we have at least one person and possibly others standing by to testify. That's correct. Linda O'Bannon. Is there anybody else that testify? Okay, Linda, if you're on the air for the record, would you identify yourself and give us your thoughts on this legislation? Thank you.
Consumer Protection Section of the Department of Law. And also with me today is Robert Mintz, who's one of the attorneys in this section. He's had a lot of experience with this act and may be able to answer some specific questions. First of all, I would like to bring to your attention a report that we prepared for the House Labor and Commerce Committee when they were considering this legislation. It was dated February 4th, 1984. Yes. I don't know if you have a copy of that, but that was a four-page summary entitled The Mobile Home Warranty Act and Consumer Problems with Mobile Homes. And it set forth our experience and the types of complaints that we had in this section since the responsibility for the Mobile Home Warranty Act was transferred pursuant to an RSA from the Department of Commerce to the Department of Law. May I ask, Mr. Chairman, if you have a copy of that report?
Yes, we do have. Thank you very much.
All right. I have a question.
Then I'll try not to repeat the...
Okay. If you could hold on just 1 second. I believe Mr. Phillips has a question on that very point.
All right.
Okay. First of all, explain RSA. And then, secondly, I have... I went through the package here earlier this morning on the bill itself. And I noticed that these duties have been transferred from Economic Development to the Department of Law. The first question came to my mind is how could this be done without a legislative approval? Because it literally changes statutes.
So, okay, there are two things I'll tell you. First of all, the physician money was transferred to the Department of Law, not the actual responsibility. That's what would actually be proposed by 148. So as it currently stands, for any administrative action, we most likely would have to have the Commissioner of Commerce approval.
Okay, what is RSA, and did the Legislative Budget and Audit actually make this transfer? Or who made the transfer?
The transfer was actually made from the Department of Commerce and Economic Development by agreement with the Department of Law. And RSA, I'm trying to think of my
reimbursable services.
Reimbursable services.
Agreement. Reimbursable services agreement. Sorry, I forgot my bureaucratic language there. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thanks.
Okay, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I wanted to clear that up. Question on his mind.
Basically, this provision would just make two changes in the law. It would, first of all, allow a private cause of action against the $35,000 bond that a mobile home manufacturer must post in order to sell mobile homes within the state of Alaska. There are no mobile home manufacturers in the state. So all the mobile homes that are sold in the state are manufactured elsewhere. The mobile home manufacturers must post this bond. It's a one-time bond, so no matter how many mobile homes they actually sell in the state, they only have to post one $35,000 bond. The way the statute is currently written, the only way that a owner of a mobile home who has a problem with their mobile home could actually recover against the bond is to go through the state, ask the state to conduct an administrative procedure in order to recover against that bond. This, of course, prevent a consumer, owner of a mobile home from going to a superior court or district court, depending on the amount of the dispute, and filing an action for breach of warranty or breach of contract, and then getting a judgment, executing on a judgment, etc. But the only problem with that, of course, is that that requires very often a lot of legal assistance, and in some cases would require legal assistance from an out-of-state attorney to attempt to execute on that judgment, which would be against an out-of-state manufacturer. What this provision would do would really provide some money that would be available if a consumer goes to court and gets a judgment that the manufacturer did not comply with the Mobile Home Warranty Act. And, of course, in those situations where the manufacturer might have gone out of business or gone bankrupt, this would provide some funds to the consumer. There are also those instances where the state may just not feel, we only have one mobile home investigator in the entire state, and this is this RSA position that was transferred from the Department of Commerce. But there may be situations, and there have been situations, where there have been individual problems with a particular mobile home manufacturer, but we did not feel that they justified an administrative procedure because it only involved one family and one mobile home. There was not a pattern of violation of Mobile Home Warranty Act. But, of course, to that particular person, their most important consumer purchases that mobile home, and they're very concerned about it and would like to have some redress against the bond in those situations. So that is the main provision, obviously, in 4530.018, adding the private cost of action against the bond. And the only other provision of any import in this House Bill 148 is the transfer of authority from the Department of Commerce to the Department of Law. And I, as I said, that was a recommendation from a legislative audit. Now, I'd be happy to answer any questions or discuss any particular positions.
Yeah, I think there's several. First, Mr. Pettijohn, then Mr. Sun.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bannon, I'm just curious, what would happen when, let's say that we have a mobile home manufacturer who has a lot of mobile homes in the state of Alaska, and in one instance, let's say that there's a cause of action against him for $35,000. This person, with the cause of action, gets the bond, all of it. Is there any mechanism is used to get the bond reinstated, to have a replacement of the bond, so to speak, so that the next person who has a claim against this manufacturer has some recourse?
Well, the current statute provides the bond, a $35,000 bond has to be in effect for up to for up to 2 years after they stop selling mobile homes in the state, so that they would have to, I think that provision would be interpreted so that they would have to continuously keep a $35,000 bond in.
Thank you.
Mr. Sun had a question.
Yeah, I have several questions. I'd like to start just with two of them. The definition of a mobile home, or the difference between a mobile home and a modular home, I assume it's defined someplace, but could you tell me where?
Well, the other term that's used very often is manufactured housing, which is not defined, as far as I know, in any of the state statutes. Mobile home is defined as 4530.100 subsection 3. And it says mobile home means a vehicle designed and equipped for human habitation and which may be drawn by a motor vehicle only when authorized by permit.
Okay, thank you very much. My second question goes to the bill on line 15 dealing with where an action can be filed. It says an action must be filed in the Superior Court of the Judicial District where the manufacturer's agent sold the home to the buyer. And then there's another
section there that where the buyer took delivery of the home, does this mean that if you bought the home in Anchorage and towed it to Fairbanks, that you have to then file the action in Anchorage even though you're living in Fairbanks?
Yes, I think it does.
This is the chair. Maybe I could ask, what's the logic of that?
Well, I think the logic of that was to file it somewhere where there was the manufacturer's agent. I think it was, obviously, it's generally the mobile home dealer. I think it was an effort to have jurisdiction where the transaction occurred, where the sales transaction occurred, and to prevent the situation where supposedly mobile homes are fairly mobile, so that someone might move it far away and it would be could be a problem to defend it in that situation. I think that was the intent.
I'd like to follow up. If you mentioned you had someone from the AG's office there, what would be the effect if on line 15, starting with the second the sentence or the action, if we deleted that all the way through line 19?
Well, I know you're working on a general venue bill, and we wouldn't have any problem, as far as I know. I'll be happy to let Robert comment also.
Tell him defeated.
Tell him we just defeated the venue bill on the floor today, so you can start from that premise.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
I don't have any further comment except to say that presumably whatever the general venue provisions are would apply here, and it probably wouldn't. I think we should probably get back to you and make sure we're getting the right answer, but it probably wouldn't be to the detriment of the consumers. It would just give additional flexibility as far as the defendant is concerned. He could be at other parts of the state than he would be otherwise.
Mr. Grunberg and then Mr. Clausen.
Ms. O'Bannon, this is Max Grunberg. I have some very specific questions.
All right.
I'm considering a few amendments at the appropriate time if they seem to the committee and you like they would be beneficial amendments. First of all, if the Consumer Protection Division is now going to be doing the administrating of this 45.30 chapter, what do you think about adding a new subsection 26 to the General Unfair Trade Practices Statute that gives you general authority, AS 45.50.471, subsection B, the term unfair methods of competition and unfair or deceptive trade practices, acts or practices, include but not limited to the following acts, and then add another provision to that sub 26, failing to comply with AS 45.30 relating to mobile homes and mobile home parks. What do you think about
that? That would be fine. There's no doubt that we already have jurisdiction in the sense that the sale of mobile homes is clearly in trader commerce, so that if there were an unfair trade practice in trader commerce. But there would certainly be no problem since this is an additional law to include that at 471B 26. Actually, I think already before you are some provisions changing 471B or adding some additional paragraphs, so it might be paragraph 28 at this point or paragraph 29.
Well, we have not yet marked up or taken up any further that House Bill 125 that you're referring to. My concern is that if you are proceeding under 45.30. There are very limited powers given to you under the mobile home statute. You don't have injunctive powers, this sort of a thing. Such an amendment would make it very clear that you could enforce it by using the full panoply of remedies available under 45.50.
Right, and I see no problem with this, but I should mention that there are two major federal preemption possible problems with 45.30 that we are just becoming more and more expert on. One is the National Mobile Home Construction and Safety Standards Act of 1974. That's just 42 U.S.C. 5401. And that comes under HUD's regulations and their extensive regulations dealing with the standards for mobile home manufacturers. The other law that, federal law that gives preemption problems with the Mobile Home Warranty Act is the Magnuson Mods Warranty Act. And that is administered by the Federal Trade Commission. And the site on that is 15 U.S.C. 2301 through 3212. We are currently in negotiation with the Federal Trade Commission as to which provisions of the Mobile Home Warranty Act are not preempted by federal law. I guess suffice it to say that it's all a very intertwined and complicated area of the law and very specialized area of the law. But nothing in the Mobile Home Warranty Act or those two federal laws would prohibit under the current Unfair Trade Practices and Consumer Protection Act any regulation of the, say, the sales practices of mobile home dealers in the state.
So such an amendment would be helpful to you then?
Yes, yes, I think it would be.
Okay, let me continue on. Now, I'm looking now at provisions of the present statute that have not been touched on. I'm talking about 45.30. Do you happen to have that in front of you, Linda?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Looking at section 45.30.015 concerning bonds, it states specifically in subsection A that a manufacturer shall deposit a performance bond, and the same thing in subsection B, performance bonds, both to and maintain the performance bond. But the purpose of the bond is to assure compliance with the provisions of AS 45.30.011. My concern is a technical one, the use of the word performance. As you're, I'm sure, aware, a performance bond is a very specific kind of a bond, particularly as used in the Little Miller Act, AS 36.25.010. There's also a payment bond, and it would be one thing to assure compliance, but I would like to also see the purchasers of the mobile homes protected against being sure that if somebody had to replace a defective appliance, that that supplier of the appliance has the appliance paid for, so they couldn't come out and lien the mobile home or repossess the appliance. And I'm considering amendments to strike the word performance from both of those subsections to make sure that the bond would, whatever the bond would be to assure compliance with the provisions of section 011. So it wouldn't be strictly limited to performance, but would include requirements that suppliers and material men and workers be paid. There'd be a payment and performance bond, but I don't think you have to say that. All you have to do is to strike the word performance. Do you follow me?
I understand what you're saying, and I don't think we have any major objection, any objection at all. My only comment would be that generally the appliances are provided by the manufacturer. I'm not aware of complaints at this point of any in the, say, the dishwasher or the washing machine or the stove being taken out because of the sorts of liens. They usually come furnished and provided to the...
I understand, but the purpose of this is to provide a bond for a suit against the manufacturer. And we're dealing with a fly-by-night manufacturer who may, in fact, not have paid for the appliance or whatever.
Right, that could happen.
Let me continue along here.
All right. Let me just make one comment, Representative Gruenberg. And the comment is that this provision, this House Bill 148, is obviously we've just made a couple suggestions. We believe that next session we're probably going to want to request the legislature to consider more extensive amendments to the current, to 4530. We feel like we're just now getting enough expertise to have a good idea of what to suggest as more extensive amendments. As I said, one of the problems in the area is just the extensive federal regulations, federal statutes, so that we want to provide protection for Alaskans, many of whom do purchase mobile homes, because we're in one of the most severe climates. We seem to have more problems with the mobile homes that are shipped into Alaska than, say, in an area that would, Florida, or some place where they don't have to worry about snow loads or moisture condensation as a result of lack of vapor barriers to mobile homes. But in gain the expertise to.
Are you saying there's not a need for the bill at the present time? Because that kind of testimony.
We're not saying that at all, and I appreciate your suggestions. You're doing some of our work for us, but. I just want you to know that
Miss O'Bannon, the reason I'm concerned is because we're under a 120-day limit down here, and if you're going to come back at us with a new bill next year, why should we deal with the same subject twice in 2 years? Other members of the committee are nodding here, and there's got to be a real good reason for dealing twice in 2 years with the same legislation.
Emergency.
Is there an emergency?
Well, the only thing I can say to you is that I think these two provisions are needed right now, and I think that they're provisions that have been considered and that are... that are really not very controversial at all. And I certainly have no problem with further suggestions. All I'm saying is that I think that there may be more extensive suggestions
Let me just briefly finish. Ms. O'Bannon, I had a couple more questions, just briefly, on a couple of amendments, but your testimony gives me serious doubts as to the necessity for this bill immediately. With respect to the actual language in the bill now, you have provided a private cause of action on the bond. I'm concerned that there is no specific mechanism set forth for a private practitioner to go after the bond. And having done some bonding practice in the past, being familiar with the contractor's license bonds in ASO 8.18, I'm considering some language that would track ASO 8.18.081 and .091, reading as follows. And this would add a new subsection B to 4530.018, and moving the present B as C. And some new subsection B would state, two copies of the complaint and the summons must be served by certified mail upon the Attorney General at the time suit is filed. At the same time, $5 must be paid to the Attorney General, taxable as costs in the action. This service upon the Attorney General shall constitute service on the surety. The Attorney General shall transmit one copy of the complaint and summons to the surety within 72 hours after it has been received. The Attorney General shall maintain a record available for public inspection of all suits commenced. End of quote. That's taken directly from the equivalent statute allowing a private cause of action on a contractor's licensing bond. Do you have any thoughts on that amendment?
No, I think that would be fine.
Let me continue. And this is taken from another provision of the same contractor's licensing, ASO 8.18.081 and ASO 8.18.091. And it would add a new section 45.30.045, titled Surety's Liability and Right to Cancel Bond. A, the surety shall inform the Attorney General in writing of, small I, all claims against the bond lodged directly with the surety, and small double I, all sums paid against the bond. Then subsection B, the surety upon the bond is not liable in an aggregate amount in excess of that named in the bond. But in case claims pending at any one time exceed the amount of the bond, the claims shall be satisfied from the bond in the order in which claims were filed with the surety directly and complaints were filed against the bond in court. Then finally, subsection C, nothing in this chapter impairs the right of a surety to cancel its bond for lawful reasons. However, no cancellation shall extinguish the surety's liability on the bond for mobile homes previously delivered in the state. Do you have any problems with that?
No, not at all. In fact, we were discussing something to that effect.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No further questions.
We have further questions by other members of the committee. Ms. Clarkson.
Ms. O'Bannon, this is Don Clarkson. A lot of the questions I have relate to what other people have already talked about. Back to Representative Pettyjohn's question with regard to the amount of the bond, $35,000 frankly does not seem like very much money. If you had a mobile home manufacturer or dealer who sells a number of mobile homes, each with the same defect, each defect being extremely expensive, you'd exceed a $35,000 bond pretty quickly. Has some thought been given to expanding the size of that bond or varying the bond by the number of units sold in the state or something like that? I have several questions, but let's try that one first.
This is the problem. I don't think the amount of the bond is sufficient at this time. As I understand it, Representative Pat Pourchaud introduced a bill to increase that bond amount. It obviously isn't enough that there are a number of consumers who bought from the same manufacturers who have major defects, and we do have a situation like that that's under investigation currently. It's very difficult to suggest what the bond amount should be. I don't think you could ever be very difficult to have a bond amount that would cover every possible situation. Obviously, that's a legislative decision to balance extent that it might discourage some manufacturers from selling mobile homes within the state to the extent that it would provide protection to consumers. If you look at the report we prepared on February 4th, we concluded that the average mobile home sold for $40,263 in mid-1984. At times, mobile homes that have sold for over $100,000. So obviously that $35,000 figure could be increased.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me ask a couple other questions. Back to Representative Gruenberg's question about the emergency that requires action on this bill this year. Frankly, I think some of his amendments are very well taken. I think that we ought to look at the size of this bond. By the way, in case you don't know it, I've got more mobile homes in my district, I think, than in any district in the state. So I'm pretty concerned about this issue. Let's be specific here. What is the reason why this legislation needs to be passed this year and can't wait for next year? If I understood your testimony correctly, there is a private right of action where a person can file directly despite 4530, whatever it is, for the department. Why do we need to pass this bill?
It's just the cause of action that would exist in common law. There's no statutory cause of action provided anywhere in 45.30, and there's no way currently for a consumer to bring a cause of action or try to claim against the bond. The only person who can claim against the bond currently is the Commissioner of Commerce on behalf of those consumers, but that requires a decision by the state that there have been violations, an administrative hearing, and then the administrative officer would make awards against the bond.
Well, but it seems, Ms. O'Bannon, that the 4530.040A1 requires a determination that there's been a violation. If somebody files a suit in court and wins, it seems to me that that's a pretty conclusive determination that somebody has violated the section. Again, not going to whether or not there needs to be an action on the bond, but whether we have to pass this bill this year rather than going back and doing some major work on all of your statute to make sure that it really is effective for consumers. My final question, if I can cheat and not wait for the answer to that one. If we deleted the section Representative Sun suggested, that is the venue provision, under the existing law, what is your understanding about where venue would lie in these types of actions?
Well, I think it could be in several places. It obviously would be where the transaction occurs. It may well be where the mobile home owner is currently living also, or where the mobile home is currently located.
If you sue it on the contract.
This is John Sund again. Another question here. Let me give the example of, I guess, the home is bought in Seattle and you bring it into the state yourself set it up. Do you have any action against that manufacturer?
No personal jurisdiction. If they're still on the state.
Well, you might have an action, but not pursuant to our Mobile Home Warranty Act.
Would the bond be available to that person, supposing that they bought it from a manufacturer who is selling other mobile homes in the state, they just happened to buy it from this specific person or manufacturer in Seattle and bring it in themselves. So the guy has a bond posted.
I think it would. It should if the manufacturer is aware that they're buying it for the purpose of putting it in Alaska or shipping it to Alaska. But if the manufacturer isn't selling any other mobile homes in the state, there is no requirement.
Yeah, that's phenomenally what we get.
But I do want to go back to Representative Klotz's comment, and that is that the private cause of action really does is allow consumer to have a available pot of money against which to claim. The only problem now is that, again, if a private action is brought in Superior Court for breach of warranty and common law action, and the consumer obtains a judgment, if it's a bankrupt corporation, or if it's a corporation that's going to hide assets, or assets aren't available, or they've gone out of business, or whatever, then the consumer judgment is really not worth very much. And that is the only advantage to the private cause of action being allowed against the bond. But it is an important one to a consumer who's not able to collect on a judgment.
Mr. Klotz, Mr. Lundberg, Mr. Tibbs.
Ms. O'Bannon, I certainly agree with that. Again, I'm trying to deal with a 120-day session problem. Do you have any specific investigations that are going on that are affected by this legislation, or an effort by a citizen to file an action on a bond that's being turned down? Any crisis situation that requires action this year?
Well, we have several investigations ongoing. There's certainly one that involves several consumers that we will most likely bring an administrative hearing and proceed against the bond ourselves. If you read the summary, you can see the number of mobile home complaints we receive. Obviously, at this point in time, if we don't feel that it justifies that procedure, then that's what we inform the consumer. We also inform them that they could seek legal counsel and file an action in court, but I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Well, Ms. O'Bannon, if I can say, the escape valve here is that you could keep handling all these cases administratively for another year while we deal with it. And again, I don't want, by my hesitation, to be on record as being against mobile home protection for consumers, because it's a real important issue with me, but it's also real tough to get a bill through this legislature, and if we're going to do it, we might as well do it with a bill that's that really carries some impact.
I understand your point of view. The only other thing I can say is that
point of view is reality.
I don't know how desirable it is to be acting under an RSA indefinitely. As I said, we have just reached this point where we realize that we will probably have to seek the Commissioner of Commerce's approval on some of our actions, and that should add an additional step. Hopefully it won't be a step that will cause us any delays, but I just don't know how long the Department of Commerce will even consider this a priority to fund.
Let Mr. Clarkson finish up and then we'll go on to the others.
Again, is there any specific legal challenge, either a formal or administrative or judicial, to your practice of RSAing? Again, I'm looking for whether there's something that requires action this year. If we can keep things rolling along for another year with the RSA, maybe we should do that. Are you aware of any specific legal challenge to your RSA procedure?
No, I'm not.
Mr. Grunberg has some questions.
This is to the chairman and also to Ms. O'Bannon. Is it ever the practice of a committee just to have a letter of intent that we understand that there is this legislation in? We understand further that they are looking at bringing the act into compliance with Magnuson laws and the other federal statute, rather than dealing with it this year on a piecemeal basis. We are simply pursuant to formal motion in committee indicating the committee's approval of the RSA for the next year. Could we do it like that and thus save a lot of time?
Well, of course, I guess we can write any letters we want to. I'm not sure, but it wouldn't carry any force. know, that can be the consensus around this table, and then we can even convey that consensus to the, for instance, Finance Committee. I guess there's nothing wrong with it. It has not been practiced, but of course, if there's a good reason to, we can always find here. Mr. Taylor, I think that's the question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this legislation is important. In fact, what we're really doing is, by allowing the private sector an opportunity to go directly against the bond, we are eliminating all of the steps, which, as Ms. O'Banion has indicated, the state's law is very circumscribed in its ability to go after dealers and distributors, manufacturers, and mobile homes. They have to be able, in essence, to show a pattern of failure to comply with the warranties before they can ever touch the bond. So as a consequence, I think anything we can do that will provide these people who are injured victims sitting out there right now with an opportunity through their own attorney that they're paying for to go after the bond which the state is sitting there holding, that it would be very beneficial to those people. In point of fact, I don't believe we need to have a state agency and state district attorneys and state other people employed going out investigating and holding administrative hearings and sending notices that no one answers. In fact, I think the law itself and the victims themselves can take care of the problem very speedily if we only, I would suggest to this committee, doubling or tripling the size of the bond and providing only for a private cause of action to be brought by the individuals. Leave the language in that Mr. Gruenberg's indicated as concerns unfair trade practices, so that if the state does want to get in and muck around with one of them that has been a flagrant violator and has a pattern of violations, they can do so. But right now, we're forcing these people to participate in the bureaucratic process of waiting for an investigator, waiting for an administrative hearing, waiting for the state to prove that there's been a pattern of other people injured before anybody's even going to look at the bond. And I can tell you from personal experience of my own on behalf of the client, it took 16 phone calls to Juneau to find out that the state even had a bond, and then who was holding the bond, and what would they would have to go through to go after the bond. And that, if I was having that kind of difficulty, imagine the difficulties that the little guy sitting out in the trailer court is having when his roof starts leaking. So it would be beneficial to these people to have it available. I don't know what Ms. O'Banion intends as additional compliance legislation with federal law, but I would submit that if it's necessary, that it should be drafted promptly and sent down to us so we can move this thing out as one package as opposed to delaying on it any further.
Mr. Goodrich.
Ms. O'Bannon, what's the possibility, just following up what Representative Taylor said, of your taking a look at the two federal statutes quickly? Is it going to have to not only move through this committee but several others, and getting some language down so we can take care of it once, but rather than waiting a year, start on it this year? Because the downside of waiting, of course, is if it doesn't get through next year, then you got another year after that. At least we get started with it this year, but it shouldn't take you that long to figure out what basically has to be done to bring it into compliance with those two federal statutes. You might have to fine-tune it as it moves through the other committees, but that shouldn't be impossible to do. Could you do that?
I don't think it's quite that simple. If the Federal Trade Commission had told us at this point in time exactly which provisions of 4508 they considered have been preempted by the Magnuson-Moss Act, we might be in a position to do that. They have given us some suggestions as to which ones are most likely preempted, and we are currently trying to get a definitive answer out of the Federal Trade Commission. Obviously, we have some opinions as to what is preempted and what isn't. Unfortunately, we differ very substantially with the Federal Trade Commission at this time. I suppose we can make a stab at it. There's certainly no guarantee that the provisions we would suggest would not be preempted.
Well, then what you're... may I finish, Mr. Chairman? As a practical matter, what you may very well be looking at is the legislature being reluctant to do anything on this bill this year. I'm just speaking personally.
Now, I understand what you're saying. The two provisions that have been proposed, though, are not provisions that run into preemption problems. And I don't think any of the provisions you suggested, making it clearer as to how to actually claim against the bond, are adding a provision in the unfair trade practices 471B26, would be preemption problems.
advised we only have a few more minutes on the teleconference network here. Do we have any other specific questions that members like to ask?
Well, I have.
Yeah, Mr. Pettijohn.
Hi, this is Representative Pettijohn again, Ms. O'Bannon. These preemption problems that you're talking about now, how critical, the fact that you're waiting until next year suggests to me that these problems are not ones that are of any critical importance at this time. Are you talking about sort of housekeeping kinds of amendments to the statute, or are you talking about major changes involving policy determinations?
I'm going to defer that question to Robert Metz, the person who's actually been negotiating with the FTC on some of these provisions.
Representative Pettijohn.
Okay, just one more question, if I might, Mr. Chairman. My feelings are sort of in line with what Representative Taylor said here, and the amendments proposed by Mr. Grunberg. I heard Ms. O'Bannon say earlier that she was working on some reforms of the Act herself. Are you, Ms. O'Bannon, are you telling us that aside from these compliance with the federal law problems, are there some other changes in these statutes that you want the legislature to consider next year that you're not capable of advising us of either today or next week?
The only changes that we're aware that we would like to suggest for later time will be the ones that will be as a result of the conflicts with the disclosure requirements in the Magnuson Lot Warranty Act.
Thank you.
The only other possibility, and this wouldn't concern state legislative action, would be an application by the state of Alaska to HUD to have specific regulations for mobile homes sold in Alaska. And that would just be because we are beginning to believe that some of the regulations aren't sufficient for Alaska. But that, again, would not involve legislative action by the state. At least not at this stage.
Mr. Chairman Miller, we're going to have to shut off in just a quick in just a minute. But I just wanted to kind of go back on one thing that's been bothering me on this too, and that is the tininess of that $35,000 bond. That's minuscule, almost to the point of being non-existent, it seems to me. When I look over your report here and see what the various problems are, defects in materials and workmanship, shoddy repair services, cracked sinks and bathtubs, doors, windows won't open and close, excessively high interior humidity. If you open all of this up to a private cause of action, which I think is a fine idea, I think that's good, but if you open that up to that sort of litigation, it seems to me the bond is going to have to be an awful lot higher. And I don't have any problem with that, but it just seems to me that the first thing we ought to determine is how much is going to be barely adequate. And I think it's way above $35,000. Would you comment on that?
Right. I think the proposal that perhaps already before the legislature was $60,000, and I think that would reflect at least more accurately the selling price of mobile homes in Alaska today. Again, as I said, obviously the legislature has to balance the restriction on the sale of mobile homes in the state if the bond is raised too high with the protection to consumers. I don't know if anyone's going to be testifying for the dealers or the mobile home manufacturers on that, but in this section, we would certainly like to see the bond raised.
Okay, I think we're going to have to shut off right now. We thank you very much for your testimony. I think we'll probably not take any action on this bill today, and we'll be back in touch with you.
We'll certainly be happy to review any suggested changes and go through the bill and make any changes that the committee would like for us to make.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We will be back in touch. That will wrap up the teleconference part of this anyway. Might say to members that they're going to need these microphones, so while we talk, people are going to have to be reaching across your shoulder and grab the mic and stuff. Mr. Clark?
Let me just say that as our discussion has gone on, I've sort of switched now to thinking that maybe we could put this bill together and move it this year. Max has done most of a lot of good work there, and that stuff sounds good to me, plus the Pettyjohn question about replacing the bond once it's exhausted seems to me that's a real serious question, and the question about the amount of the bond. If you could throw all those together, you'd have a pretty good bill, and maybe it doesn't take as long as either Max and I or I thought it might at the beginning of this hearing. Maybe we could do it this year.
Well, sounds to me like these changes they're going to come back and ask for next year, it isn't going to matter that much whether they're done next year or not. It's a real technical housekeeping kind of stuff, and the substantive stuff, the policy stuff, she says, in answer to my question, that basically it's all on the table right here, right now.
Yeah. And then let me just finish by saying I think if we're going to do that, we could prepare, probably wouldn't take over a week or so to prepare a real good committee substitute, but that's what you ought to show to the mobile home industry.
Yeah.
More honest indication of our efforts.
Mr. Grunberg,
my suggestion then, if in that Hagen could mail my amendments with the exception. I have one in there that, that says about this venue, and I think that depends on whether anything ever happens with the venue bill.
That'll be resolved before you get
But if they...
You got to vote, Mr. Bishop.
We're working on it, Mr. Chairman.
That would be my input, Hagen, just my, those amendments, and then you can take these others and just mail them in the committee session.
Of course, I adopted my amendment. You wouldn't have to worry about Max's venue question. I guess there's a whole bunch of...
There's nothing wrong with your amendment. It's a good amendment, isn't it?
But my mobile home issue that is coming up, you know, I don't know how to deal with it. Maybe you guys have it, but notice to shut down half a mobile home park, just had Robin and I and Kathy came in. They had 60 days to move out and no place to go. Type issue. And then got a couple bills coming up in the loans committee on mobile homes and the relocation loans. And you know, it's that whole mess, and I don't know how it all ties together, but mobile homes in this case, just, they always have been a problem, and always will be a problem. I'm not saying how to tie it into this bill, I'm just saying that there's other mobile home bills that are indirectly rolling around.
Did you find Porsche's?
I couldn't find it.
We couldn't find it. I think he must have indicated he's going to file.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what it'll be, it'll be at least a week and a half, in fact, more than that, 2 weeks before we can reschedule anyway, so we've got some time to draft. I think committee substitution is a good thought. We will notify the manufacturers and the dealers. We have a
essential. Could we have a hearing within the next week before?
Say again, 2 weeks.
Within the next couple of weeks, we'll have another hearing.
Yeah. And then we can make a go, no-go decision.
Yeah.
I don't think it'll be that terribly complicated if we decide to go with it.
And then,
when she started talking about combining with the feds, I have given her another 12 or 18 pages just combined with the feds. I don't
know if Mr. Sun.
Let me make a venue.
Start about
line
15.
G-I-R-A-F-F-E.
I think it is quite as simple as you suggested, but
line 15 to 19.
I think you could just say, hey, the action must be filed in the Superior Court, period.
Yeah.
And eliminate everything after Superior Court.
Yeah.
Why would it have to be Superior Court, Max? What if you got a claim for $2,000?
That's a good point.
Up to 25,000 if you vote for the next bill.
Yeah.
Why not just eliminate everything in line 15 after 0.015?
That's what I propose.
Yeah.
That's great.
If you file anywhere, anytime.
Any place, babe.
Any court that'll hear it.
Yeah.
You got it.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. We're, for the moment at least, through with that for today.
Me.
This needs signature. What we have here is a letter, which we're obligated under the rules to file, we hadn't realized this, relative to the Bar Association. We need to, we've already passed the bill, so this is a technicality that needs to be accommodated as well. Instead, we will be hearing a bill, I mean, we will be having the subject come up before too long, on continuing the code revision, and specifically relative to the budget audit of that thing. And we need to send them a letter. We need to, the law says before the 60th day, we're supposed to submit a report similar to what you're signing right now for the Bar Association. It's very difficult to accommodate that law by the 60th day, in as much as we only received the letter about 3 days ago. So we have asked the our legislative attorney what happens if that doesn't happen. As a matter of fact, nothing happens. If we wanted to put them out of business, we probably would have had it before the 60th day, but if, assuming that we want to continue them in business, nothing happens. For some reason or other, the report that would have triggered our response was never sent to us until, let's say, 3 or 4 days ago. So we'll hold that bill, I mean that hearing on that subject matter, probably within the next week or so. I don't know of anybody that's concerned about the exuberance of the commission for work on it. Yeah, okay. Next bill to bring up is SB 124, an act relating to judicial vacancies and providing for effective date. This is this identical to the, is there any changes at all?
I might be passed out with individual.
What was the number?
Wait.
124 is the Senate bill that we're considering right now. 116 is the House bill that we consider. And in as much as this is not a committee substitute, I presume it's identical to what we
passed that. 116, which title change to keep anybody else from messing with it. But, and we, it was passed out, and rules had it, but in the meantime, the Senate bill was passed and came over, so.
I would move that it be passed out with individual recommendations with the title change.
With the title?
Yep.
You don't need to now.
We can't change the title.
You don't need to, because it's already been taken care of.
If you're worried about the other house messing up.
You're worried about the other house.
Oh, I see. Okay, then I move it past that with individual recommendations.
Actually, who's worried about me?
Object for a question. The motion, Max's motion, passes out of this committee and a bill identical to the one we've already passed out, except for a tighter title. Is that right?
We didn't change the bill.
How'd that go down?
Do pass.
Can you read the question?
Objection.
Okay, hearing no objection, the bill will pass out of committee with individual recommendations.
Wow.
No.
Oh, yeah, we'll send it along.
So we gotta talk to our
Carla, you gonna get some words of wisdom?
Beat us to the trigger every time.
While I'm preparing this to send around, I will take up Senate Bill 1 at this time. Carla, if you agree with us on that.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Carla Forsyth, General Counsel to the Court System. You've looked at this bill before. It accomplishes five things. First of all, it raises district court jurisdiction to $25,000. We started out in 1959 with jurisdiction at $3,000. 13 years later, it went to $10,000. That was in 1972, and it's 13 years since that time. And now asking for an increase to $25,000, primarily to keep up with inflation, while maintaining the character of the district court as a relatively expeditious forum for processing disputes. The second thing that this legislation does is provide that suits must be filed in the district court if they fall within this monetary limit, except the Supreme Court will adopt a rule that will provide essentially that cases that are more complex or that for some other compelling reason ought to be heard in Superior Court can be moved to Superior Court, probably after some sort of motion and hearing. The third thing that...
Excuse me, does this bill mandate the Supreme Court will adopt that rule, or does the Supreme Court already have such a rule? That will apply. Will now apply to the new limits, previously applied to the old limits, or
Mr. Chairman, the Supreme Court does not have such a rule now, and I don't know that you could read this language as requiring the Supreme Court to adopt it, but the Supreme Court has every intention of doing that.
I was reading something.
The third thing that this bill accomplishes is it permits domestic violence injunctions to be heard in the district court. Basically, the rationale for that is it means more people available to hear these cases, which come in on an emergency basis. It should expedite the processing of those cases. A fourth thing that this bill does is provides that lien enforcement, if the lien falls within the jurisdictional limit of district court, could take place in district court. And finally, the bill has an effective date of July 1. The primary reason for that, rather than an immediate effective date, is to give the Supreme Court time to pass that rule. And it also provides that this bill only applies to cases that are filed after the effective date, so there's a very clear, bright line as to which cases are effective and which cases are not.
I there are two of you walking when you live ahead. I can't do three things at once. Two is all right. Would you give me the last thing that you mentioned in the bill that you mentioned before, and then I started doing something else and I missed
it. The last thing it does is provides an effective date of July 1st.
Oh, okay, before that, I'm sorry.
Okay, the lien enforcement, that a variety of types of liens could be enforced in district court as long as they fell within the district court monetary limit.
Okay. We have questions, Mr. Member.
And I was going to propose some, indicate some of the changes in the committee substitute. Am I out of order?
Can we just do that?
There were a couple of things that were melded into the committee substitute as a result of some proposed suggestions I had. May I mention that, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. We're talking about a House committee substitute now.
Right.
That you want to see adopted as opposed to the report you just gave us, what's in the Senate.
Mr. Chairman, it would be easier. It doesn't really matter to me. I think I can address the changes that Mr. Groom, Representative Broomberg is talking about. There are Those are the major things the bill accomplishes. It also provides that in addition to counseling and other sorts of things that can be ordered in the context of a domestic violence injunction, that mediation can be ordered as well, and mediation is a remedy that's available under existing law.
That's on page 5, line 18.
And then also in sections 12 and 13, it attempts to address the possible interrelationship of this bill to the ill-fated venue proposal may or may not see the light of day. But basically providing that if it, and the reason that that's in there is that the lien enforcement statute now provides for venue, and since that would be encompassed by a Supreme Court rule, it would conform it to that. And there may be other amendments as well.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Remember.
Since this whole thing arose, and I was looking at that mobile home law, I mentioned that I looked at the contractor's licensing bond law, remember? And that brought to mind a problem that I encountered when I was in private practice. And I'm going to hand out another proposal.
I thought you still were, man.
So you quit? You retired now?
Well, according to my partner, I hope I'm still talk to her at lunch. Yeah.
Oh,
this is for the staff. For you. and that is, the present contractor's license law contains a provision concerning going after a bond. It's an action on a bond. And this is ASO 8.18.081. And the present language in this, these bonds are presently either $2,000 or $5,000. And there's a bill that's making its way through the House now to raise it all the way to $10,000. These things, according to the present language, have to be brought in the Superior Court. But there is some question about that. I represented a bonding company and a contractor's license bond, and an action was commenced in the district court, and I moved to dismiss on the basis that this statute says Superior Court. Judge Fohaska, in his infinite wisdom, denied my motion. This was before he was not retained.
Yes.
denied my motion to dismiss.
Shortly before he left the bench.
Shortly before he left the bench. And he also denied another motion.
Is there a cause and effect?
I don't think so. But then we appealed to Judge Moody. And Judge Moody affirmed Judge Wohaska's decision that this could be brought in the district court. This was shortly before Moody left the bench. But he granted my motion to dismiss on another basis. But I don't think there's any reason these little contractors' bonds should be brought in the Superior Court. And that is what this amendment does. And I request it be tacked onto the bill. And then, because of the ill-fated venue legislation, this also has similar language on the, and you can see Section 2 would say in which venue lies rather than the present language, and that would be if the venue bill is reconsidered successfully. So I would move my amendment be tacked on, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have any comments?
Mr. Chairman, we certainly would be in favor of that. Senate Bill 127, it incorporates exactly the same language that's now in Labor and Commerce, and we'll have to go to the Senate Judiciary. So there is action on the Senate side similarly, and I can assure you that Judge Cerdaley is in favor of this. And I've also, if I want just one more comment, I've also checked with the Department of Commerce Occupational Licensing, Harry Traeger, and they're in favor of this legislation as well.
160 is my bill.
I thought it was the governor's bill that was moving.
No, it's
yours.
Fault.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Up in finance.
Well, I that was.
Pulling a bill out of committee.
The proposed amendment triggers the question with regard to, and I'm looking at this, which I guess is Max's proposed committee substitute. Is that where we are here?
I think some of Carla's stuff's in there, and my previous stuff was in there, everything except the contract.
Sure, my
stuff.
Question. The significant, I'm trying to determine the significance of the provision on page 2, line 23. Or in the 14-inch version, page 2, line 24 and a half, that says the wording is different here, but in the one version it says that an action that's to be filed in district court may not be filed in Superior Court with some stated exceptions. I don't know if that's the existing policy, I haven't had a chance to read all this. Is that the existing policy, and how would that affect then your proposed amendment? That would mean that you have no choice but to bring suit upon a bond in district court, and I can imagine some cases where the bond would be substantial.
No, the contractor's licensing bonds at present for a specialty bond is only $2,000. That's the total amount of the bond. So your claim could not exceed $2,000 on a specialty licensing bond. And the general contractors only have a $5,000. This isn't a performance or payment bond. It's a licensing bond. And it is $5,000 now, and it will be raised under Representative Sun's bill. Is it the $10,000?
General contractors go to $10,000, and subcontractors go to $5,000.
So they're really small bonds.
I'm cool with bonds.
Okay, well, that takes care of the question with regard to the bonding amendment. But what about the general principle of not allowing someone to go into superior court on these certain listed kinds of cases? That strike anybody else as strange, or is it just me?
It says, except under rules provided by the court, Mr. Chairman. See, on line 28, page 2. So they would be able to, I assume, say, in complex questions of law, where there are large classes of people involved, or far-reaching effect.
Did we just go off the air here?
No, we're being recorded. This was the teleconference.
We're not being recorded.
You're being recorded up there.
Yeah, up there.
Oh, okay.
Let me ask, I'm getting a nod, which doesn't go on to the tape recording. What is the position? Why does the court system think that we need to make this exclusive jurisdiction in district court for these kind of cases, except for those accepted by court
rules? Mr. Chairman, Representative Clausen, that's correct, and the reason for that is a concern that unless this sort of provision were inserted, that these cases would still continue to be brought in superior court, because many attorneys prefer, for whatever reason, to file in superior court. And if this is to be an effective change, that there needs to be a bright line, and there needs to be a statement that says these cases will be brought in district court. But there's also recognition on the part of the Supreme Court there needs to be a loophole, that there may be certain sorts of cases that, even though they are below $25,000, have major constitutional issues, or, as Representative Broomberg indicated, affect a large class of people or other compelling circumstances. And so there would be a rule that would permit those cases to transfer up, and my understanding from the court so far is that that'll be a very broad rule to allow a motion and a hearing on whatever sort of facts might arise that would seem to warrant that.
But I don't remember the status of courts around the state, but aren't we in a trend the last few years to establish superior courts in rural areas, and in at least some of those, Valdez is the most recent example, you have terminated the district court. So if you require that an action be brought in district court, the effect of that in rural areas may be the reverse of what we thought we were doing by opening superior courts there, which is to make those actions could be brought in the rural areas. Isn't that the effect of it?
It's a crazy situation. And what really happens is you end up with district / superior court judgeships.
You've got a district court jurisdiction in Valdez, for
Wrangell,
example?
Yeah, in Paul. And
in fact, I remember this committee last year, or 2 years ago, whenever it was, specifically said the condition of getting a superior court in Valdez is terminating the district court.
It did terminate it, Tom. What happens is the district court judge there retired, just as I did in Wrangell. Mm-hmm. And then the new person appointed sits, okay, just as Dwayne Krask does, or Roy Madsen in Kodiak, sits, yeah, as a district / superior court judge, handles both types of cases. If it's a case that involves district court jurisdiction, he is at that time, quote, a district court judge. If it has to be appealed to a superior court judge, he, of course, doesn't hear his own appeal. He just sends the paperwork on to another judge. Usually the presiding judge in the district would then decide it or assign it to someone.
Is that inconsistent with what I thought that was the direction of this committee a couple of years ago when we created the judgeship in Valdez, that you had to terminate the district court first?
I don't think so, because I think the concern there was that there not be two judges in Valdez. And Representative Taylor is correct. The superior court always can hear a district court matter. The Superior Court always has the jurisdiction to do that if it wants to.
Okay, I guess that's what I've been searching for. This doesn't supersede that
no
principle with regard to the smaller courts where they're combined.
No, and it's an anomaly of our system having what are essentially rural courts where it just makes cost-effective sense to have a Superior Court judge there to do the felonies and things that arise. Then we have Anchorage and Fairbanks and Juneau that are more traditional metropolitan areas that justify two different levels in one location. It's somewhat of an anomaly based on Alaska circumstances. But it will not interfere with those courts' abilities to hear those cases.
Yes. Yeah,
Well, I would like to inquire of Ms. Forsythe and perhaps also of Mr. Grunberg, who has worked on this bill, why we do not allow a district court judge to hear a case of seduction upon a promise to marry. We do not allow a district court judge to hear a case involving criminal conversation, which is not what you think it is, Randy.
Are you reading these from a bill?
Yeah. Page 3, line 5 and 6. As long as we're shaping up our statutes here, I think that if you wanted to file a case of criminal conversation in district court, you ought to be able to do that. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Grunberg?
Just speaking both as a person and a family lawyer, I wonder why we need to have criminal conversation cause of action and seduction. I'd hate to think of all the potential defendants out there.
Really? I'm trying to remember what criminal conversation is.
It's basically
adultery.
Adultery kind of stuff.
Criminal conversation is adultery.
I believe so.
Yeah. You did get rid of Oprah.
No, I think it's the seduction of a married woman.
I
thought Oprah.
And you
was
sue the paramour.
Yeah, you sue the you sue when you're you've been what do you call it?
Alienation of affection.
Huh? Cuckolded. That's right. Cuckolded. You sue the guy that did this with your wife.
Or vice versa.
I want to be
it's just amazing what you pick up when you sit on the committee like this.
Well, if you're ever accused of criminal conversation, it's not what you think it is.
I've been prepared not to be worried about it. I would find out it's a moral thing.
Anyway, I'm not entirely joking here. I wonder if we really need that stuff there.
Of course, that's current law.
I've often advocated for a rule that for every crime we create, we have to eliminate
a couple.
Well, why not eliminate criminal conversation and seduction upon a promise to marry? Anyway?
I'll second that motion.
Okay, let me ask this question.
I want Fritz to carry the bill on this one.
if we do that in this limited instance, right?
Yeah,
is there any fallout down the line? It seems like
in other statutes.
We're not eliminating the underlying.
We're just saying the district court can handle it.
That way they can bring either a small seduction case or a big
Mr. Chairman, may I have
it really does terminate for all time. The difference.
It has to be in Superior. It will have to be.
It's an historic event.
Yeah. Well, that's the basis for this, Mr. Chairman, if I can. I can't do as well as Max does, but the basis for the difference between Superior and District Court was that
used to be.
That district court would only handle money matters, and Superior Court handled all your equity matters.
Mm-hmm. But
once you move injunctive relief into district court, which we're doing here, that's one of the proposals, is to give this district court injunctive relief matters, which are equitable matters.
No? Really?
Yes.
Well, let them get you an injunction?
In domestic violence.
Oh, in domestic violence.
Well, you're doing lien law on the back of this bill.
Well, not a regular injunction.
We're not really letting them touch title. You notice that? Can't talk about title, real property.
Wait, let me tell you, the line of distinction has not only been blurred, it is getting grayer.
Mr. Grunberg.
Originally, ASO 9.15.030 provided that unmarried females may sue for seduction. But the 1974 legislature, in an act of wisdom, repealed that. And so now all we have is that parents or guardians may sue for the seduction of a child. And it says a parent may, and this is 09.15.020, a parent may maintain an action as plaintiff for the seduction of a child below the age of majority. The guardian may maintain an action as plaintiff for the seduction of a ward. The action may be maintained even though the child or ward is not living with or in the service of the plaintiff at the time of the seduction or afterwards, and there is no loss of service.
You want to keep going on this, man?
We ought to hang this, keep this bill around for a while. I don't think we can think of some interesting amendments.
Well, I'm sure.
Relating to the jurisdiction of the courts, it's a pretty broad title.
I don't think we should let them have it back.
We're fast running out of time. What do the members want to do with this?
Yeah, I think we ought to let it go. But I Mr. Chairman, I question Representative Grunberg's attempts to make the effective dates dependent upon whether or not the venue bill, a venue bill.
No. It didn't. It Mr. Chairman, may I respond to that? The only thing that does Representative Pettyjohn relates to sections 9 and 10.
Yeah.
These are alternative language on venue.
Oh, I see.
And if the venue bill passes, then line 23 on page 7 becomes operative, in which venue lies. In other words, the Supreme Court will say, if the venue bill doesn't pass, then the present language in section 9 becomes operative. It only applies to those two, nothing the rest.
Is this your idea, Max, to have two alternative sections which are triggered by the possible passage of a bill, which is... I don't recall having seen this done before, and perhaps...
Yeah, it has been done. I've seen it.
Okay.
This will be long past before...
Okay, well, yeah, then I don't see a problem with it.
I would move the bill as amended.
With the additional amendments proposed by Mr. Grunberg.
Grunberg amendments.
What about the Pettyjohn amendment?
Yeah, and the Pettyjohn amendments, if he wishes.
Only one.
No objection. One
Pettyjohn amendments being the two categories you just mentioned.
Criminal conversation and seduction upon a promise to marry Doyle.
Those would be put in brackets and deleted.
Right.
Everybody understand?
Deleted meaning that they would be... District Court would have jurisdiction.
No, you didn't have jurisdiction.
Deleted from this bill. Not deleted.
Maybe I ought to break it up. I assume he's moving for his amendment first. Is he moving for his amendment if there's going to be a problem on his amendment?
Well, if there's going to be a problem, it's six separate votes.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Is there objection to Mr. Pettyjohn's amendment? I hear none.
Okay. Then I would move the bill as amended.
Move the bill. The committee substitute is prepared by Mr. Grunberg and is amended by Mr. Grunberg and Mr. Pettyjohn.
Right.
I object for a second. I guess I'm bothered bottom page 2. Except as provided by rules of the Supreme Court, which don't exist.
Does that mean you're voting with me, Don?
I'm getting close to you, Don. I'm moving around here.
Situation's fluid, right?
You know, we're just dumping. Not that I don't like the Supreme Court, but we are sure giving them a free hand to write whatever they want. I mean, who wouldn't pass a law that? No, is it something that we have to do? Is that last paragraph have to be in there?
It's not. You got to do something else. Or else you're locking it into only the district court.
But this will allow, in some cases, you to bring it in the superior court. For example, if it's something of constitutional dimensions or widespread, you know, statutory implication, and save the people that want to fill it. And it will be the exceptional circumstance, but I think the Supreme Court
I guess I get back to the case of the quality of the district court judgeships. You know, what happened here in Juneau for many, many years, you're always preemptive on the criminal side, but if you're mandated to file in their jurisdiction on the civil side, there's no way around it.
Preemptive?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, we have before us the motion to move the bill with individual recommendations. I yield to the pleasure of the chair with regard to moving the bill out. I am going to be a no rack. I think that it's a long bill with several changes, and I'm concerned about some of the things Representative Sund is with regard to the equity law distinction and what we're doing to district courts. What the dynamic of that is on the flow of work in appellate cases, for example. I'm not sure I understand the implications. I'll be in no rack.
It would accommodate either one of you, but I'd be glad to hold this order for a few days to even suggest some amendments if you want.
I don't have any amendments, to be perfectly candid. The only reason I can think of holding it is the fact that it's a Senate bill. But
except in this case, it's a Senate bill by two members of the minority who dropped in at the request of the court. I guess my only comment,
I'll yield to let the chair and go with it too, but I think I'll probably be a no rec for the same reason, and that's just that. But what I don't really care to see happening is that every time we come out of here with something that we're none of us really happy for, you know, we go up and fight it out on the floor, and you know, today we had three of the five lawyers up, and we probably get five out of five up on this one here, and it doesn't give much direction to the floor.
This is why people can come up with amendments to make them feel more comfortable. We got this knowledge division on the question, and I don't see anything to do about it. Discussion on the floor.
I
Well, Chairman,
are you gentlemen suggesting that if the language allowing domestic violence injunctions was removed, that that would satisfy your principal objection? If that's an amendment, I'd like to consider it because I might vote for it.
I need to look at that question. I feel very connected to the domestic violence procedures. I had something to do with writing it. I really haven't. Part of this is I've been goofing off. I haven't called Andy Brown. I know he supports this, but I'd like to talk to him about it. I do have questions about the idea of mandatory district court jurisdiction. I'm satisfied now with regard to rural areas, but I just don't understand what it means. I guess I would.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm going to request that the bill be held, and you can put a deadline on me, and I'll do some work on it and get back. But I guess I would ask that it be held.
Well,
I was
just
going to
suggest
until
Thursday, if that's all.
Well,
I have no objection to that either. I'm quite sympathetic to the reason.
And, you know, you may be able to develop a consensus, at least among this committee, and avoid some floor stuff.
Okay. If there's no objection, I'll just hold the chair, hold the bill, and schedule it this time for the record. Now, can I have your attention real briefly here? We have a, in order to move things along in the 120-day session, we have a bill here that we've been asked if we could possibly consider waiving. I haven't read the bill. I've asked Hayden to, but I haven't even had a chance to ask him his reaction. This bill relates to the use of teleconferencing under the Administrative Procedures Act. What it does, puts the stamp of approval on a teleconference meeting, a legal stamp of approval. I think a lot of people, probably including myself, think that teleconference meetings are legal right now, except there may be a cloud there. So several people for several years have recommended that we remove that cloud and make a decision. I guess I should probably just take a copy of this to everybody.
I think there's a provision allowing that in Title 10 now.
I don't think so.
No, not enough.
If it is, it isn't sufficient because we...
Be 44 to be effective. Who's that sponsor?
Well, this is by it's by the governor, and it's already been heard by the House Special Committee on Telecommunications. It's referring to telecommunications, judiciary, and finance. And I know this will come up, for instance, during the interim when the Legislative Council will have some meetings and we want the teleconference. And the question always arises whenever we do, is this a binding or a legal vote and somebody votes from 500 miles away?
Well,
the answer has usually been, we think so.
In litigation, right?
Yeah, and I'd want to take a look at that because, I mean, they're teleconferencing APOC meetings right now. And I wasn't directly involved, but I know someone who was. And they felt that the decision was directly affected by the fact that it was a teleconference and not a personal meeting.
Okay, well, that's the input I want. I'm not going to waive the bill then because we'll try to expedite it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, there might be no fiscal impact at all. So we
just for the information of the committee, the section on corporations, which allows this, is AS 10-05-199.
Yep, corporations, yeah.
Yeah, not a
but not a governmental to do it. Okay, we'll hear the bill and we'll move as fast as we can.
I will do that.
Okay, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Sound like my constituents already.